So the next item is agenda paper 3 on goodwill and impairment. The board will be publishing a discussion paper with its preliminary reviews in around mid-March. And the objective of the discussion paper is to improve the information that companies provide to you, investors at a reasonable cost about the companies that they buy. And the board is mainly trying to seek comments from stakeholders on how useful and feasible they think some of those disclosure ideas are, as well as whether they have any new evidence or arguments on how goodwill should be accounted for. The purpose of the meeting today is to provide an overview to members on the preliminary reviews that will be included in the discussion paper and to provide any clarification on questions that members may have. Then, at the joint meeting with CMAC in June, we plan to ask members for their early feedback on the discussion paper, and the deadline for submitting comment letters will be in mid-September. The other area of focus for the meeting today is to seek members' advice on how they think the board should best go about with its outreach and fieldwork activities after the discussion paper has been published, so that we'll be able to get the best response possible through this exercise. So I will just very briefly provide an overview of the board's preliminary reviews that are included in the DP. So on slide 8, it summarizes the feedback that the board has heard relating to the disclosure requirements on business combinations, as well as on the accounting of goodwill. Then slide 9 provides a summary of the board's preliminary review for each of these main areas where the board has looked at in the discussion paper. Most of those views were decided during the board's meeting in June last year. The preliminary review covers three main areas. The first area relates to disclosure about the performance of acquisitions, and the purpose of those disclosures is to provide users with the information they need to better understand the objectives that management have when they decided to acquire a company, and also on whether this acquisition has been successful in subsequent periods. We have talked about some of those disclosures in our previous meetings, and slides 11 to 14 provides a reminder of the board's preliminary review on those areas. The key principle here is that companies will be required to disclose the information that management use internally to monitor the acquisitions. There are also some targeted improvement to existing IFRS 3 disclosure requirements, which are set out on slide 15. The second area that the board has looked at is on the accounting for goodwill. Slides 18 and 19 outline the board's efforts to improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, which was also discussed in one of our previous meetings. The board did not decide on a could not find a better alternative to the existing impairment test in IAS 36. Because goodwill does not generate cash flow on its own, the test has to look at whether a set of assets as a whole is recoverable or not, or whether impairment is needed. The board has also considered whether to reintroduce amortization, and some of these arguments both for and against the reintroduction of amortizations are set out on slide 21. Because there's no compelling evidence to suggest that reintroducing amortization will significantly improve financial reporting, the board decided by a narrow margin to retain the existing impairment-only approach. And the board would welcome stakeholders' view on this topic, especially whether they think there's any new evidence or argument supporting either of these two approaches. There's also some views for the suggestion to simplify the existing impairment test, which are set out on slides 22 to 24. First, by amending how this value in use could be estimated, and also a potential move to a trigger-based impairment test. In the board's view, performing the impairment test only if the company thinks that there's an indicator of impairment will result in only a marginal reduction in the robustness of the test, and that is mainly because it is unlikely that a material impairment loss would have occurred without an indicator of impairment in the first place. Finally, the board has also considered some other topics as well. It has tentatively decided to require companies to present on the balance sheet an amount representing total equity excluding goodwill It has also looked at whether to subsume some intangible assets acquired in an acquisition into goodwill, but decided not to do so, mainly because there's no compelling evidence. So on slide 29, the board's package of preliminary reviews tries to achieve an overall balance between costs and benefits. And without going into the specific details on each of those items, the slide summarizes the board's initial assessment. So at this point, I would like to pause and ask members if they have any questions or would like to have any clarification.
Actually, just before we open the floor, it's probably just worth me. I just wanted to just make a couple of comments regarding, within the discussion paper, some of the areas that the board's looking for particular feedback on. That's particularly relevant, I think, to companies and to preparers. So I thought that might be useful. So just going through some of those preliminary views, on the disclosures about subsequent performance, I mean, this is an area that the board particularly would like to hear from companies about how feasible they think the suggestions are and how useful the information may well be from those suggestions. And that's partly the purpose of the fieldwork that we'll talk about a little bit later. But from that fieldwork and also the outreach and comment letters, the board's particularly wanting to get a better understanding of which acquisitions companies actually do monitor and how companies actually go about monitoring those acquisitions. And also acknowledging some of the issues with providing some of this type of information. For example, the information might be considered to be commercially sensitive, but also acknowledging that it's in the view of the board, it's a reasonable request from investors that they get information about how an acquisition is performing. And also a reasonable expectation that companies do know how their acquisitions, maybe in the initial stages at least, are actually performing. I think the board's hoping that companies can provide and can offer some constructive feedback on if some of those issues, such as commercial sensitivity of some of the information, are concerns. Yeah, how can the board actually still provide information about the performance of acquisitions that will still be useful to investors whilst addressing some of those concerns as well? So that's a particular area the board is trying to get feedback on and to help it make the decisions as it thinks about the next steps in the project. Then on amortisation and impairment and that debate, as Dayhouse says, board's looking for new evidence, new arguments on that debate. But it also, I think that could also include maybe some old arguments and the reasons why some of those old arguments are more relevant today based on what we know today and the context of where we are today regarding acquisitions and the impairment test and so on and so forth. The board's been looking at this, I think, from the perspective of looking at it as an overall package. I mean, the overall objective is providing better information to investors about the acquisitions that are being made to allow them to hold management to account. And I think the board's consideration of which accounting model might be best, for example, amortization or impairment only, it's in that context of, well, what's the best model then to hold management to account? And it's also in the context of this is an overall package of proposals, and so there are other elements of the proposals, such as the disclosures on subsequent performance that provide some additional information, and it's thinking about, and the board encourages in the discussion paper stakeholders to think about this as an overall package and think about, well, what is the best package of different views that will help investors hold management to account for some of those acquisition decisions. And to the extent that stakeholders might prefer an amortisation model. It'll be looking for stakeholders to say, well, how and why amortisation, especially if it is on an arbitrary basis in terms of its life, how does that actually hold management to account better than the impairment test? And to the extent that, and it will again, will be looking for feedback on whether companies are likely to adjust or add back amortisation expenses in their management performance measures if amortisation was reintroduced. To the extent, if that was the case, how does that sort of tally up with holding management to account and how they see those two things tally up? But as I said, this is an overall package, and we'll be also trying to explore whether actually, given that there's disclosures now or proposed disclosures on the subsequent performance, stakeholders may feel that, well, that provides the information that allows investors to hold management to account, and that therefore might allow an accounting model such as amortisation, that some feel is a simple and a less costly model to account for goodwill, that might allow the board to think about that in that context, because the holding to account bit has been dealt with through the disclosures. So I think the board's very keen for the stakeholders to think about the preliminary views as an overall package and think about the overall objective that the board has for this discussion paper and for the topics within the discussion paper. And the last thing I think on amortisation, just to say, is again from specific feedback from companies, I think the board will be hoping for feedback on whether companies feel that they can reasonably estimate the useful life of goodwill and how they actually think they can do that. On the indicator-based impairment test, I think this is an area that the board's keen to hear from companies about their views on the cost that that could save and the extent of cost savings by moving to an indicator-based test. That is definitely an area where the board has heard different views on the extent of those cost savings, and so that's the board's keen to get a clearer picture of what stakeholders think on the extent of those cost savings and what types of costs and the nature of costs that are actually saved. And also keen to hear from companies about the effect that moving to an indicator-based test could have on robustness and whether companies think that the impairments that they are recognising today under the existing impairment test, whether under an indicator-based test, that they would still be identifying and recognising the same impairments, and whether it's likely that they would expect to see an indicator of an impairment for the types of impairments that are recognised today, to give the board an understanding of how expensive the impact of moving to an indicator-based test could be on the robustness of that test, and whether in the board's preliminary view it's potentially going to be marginal, and whether stakeholders support that. And then finally, on intangible assets, as Deha said, the board's preliminary view is not to subsume some of the identifiable intangible assets into goodwill. And again, this is an area where the board wants to get a clearer understanding of the impact, that if they had a different preliminary view and were to subsume some of those identifiable intangible assets into goodwill, actually what's the extent of the cost that might save for companies in terms of identifying and valuing those types of intangibles or some of those intangibles, and the information that might be lost, because again that's an area where the board heard different views on the information content of those requirements, the current requirements, and the costs associated with those, which is the reason why the board's preliminary view was that it had no compelling evidence at that point in time to suggest that it should make a change. So I just thought before we started, it was just worth giving a bit of an outline of the type of feedback that the board is looking for. And as Deha said, we'll be pleased to hear your feedback in June. We're planning to have, so in June there will be a joint session with CMAC, the investor advisory group, And we're planning to have a session in June to go through your early feedback on the board's preliminary views. Once you've had a chance to read and digest the discussion paper that's currently being drafted, and once you've had an understanding of the rationale that the board has set out in that discussion paper for its different preliminary views. Sorry, I slightly hijacked Dayhal there. So I think we were just asking members, before we move on to talk about the plans for outreach and fieldwork, whether you've got any questions or clarifications about the board's preliminary views.
Okay, thanks, David. Thanks, Tim. What views? This is an important topic. Christoph.
If he, as you asked for, start with questions, the monitoring of Activision, if I've understood the paper correctly, it's not necessarily a monitoring on the level of the individual acquisition, but if the acquisition is integrated in something larger, and you monitor that something larger, then you would report on that. Now, if the something larger, let's assume, is an operating segment, I will not discontinue monitoring the operating segment. So does that mean that as long as this operating segment exists, I'm deemed to monitor the acquisition because I'm monitoring the operating segment? Could even be that the bigger thing is the company as a whole. And of course, management will monitor revenue and profits of the company as a whole. So when do I exit the monitoring exercise or the reporting on the monitoring exercise if the thing that I'm monitoring is not the individual acquisition but a larger thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, the key thing here, I guess, is management is monitoring the acquisition against its expectations at the acquisition date or when it entered into the acquisition as to what it thought the acquisition would. What was its key objectives and how it thought the acquisition was going to meet those objectives and how it was going to measure those objectives. And so the expectation in the board's preliminary view is that information would be provided for as long as management are actually monitoring it. But the key thing here is the distinction between monitoring it from a segment perspective, as you would do currently just because of how you monitor, you manage your business and monitor your business, and monitoring it specifically against what you expected the acquisition to do when you actually entered into that acquisition. And there will become a point in time, one would think, that you would assess that, well, I'm happy now that I don't need to keep on going back to I expected this to increase my revenue by a certain amount, or I expected an increased market share, or I expected to launch a particular product. Management would at some point in time stop when it feels that it's understood how successful an acquisition is. There will be a point where it will move on and won't start looking back at those original acquisition date metrics and objectives and targets.
I'm just trying to operationalize that. Maybe using the example, we make an acquisition and the product of the acquired company is something that would be integrated in a larger product. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that product is an operating segment. So my expectation is the acquisition will help me increase my revenues in this product and keep it on a higher level. Mm-hmm. That doesn't end. It would end if I should I ever retire the product, but that may be not foreseen at any point. Mm-hmm. So that's where the scenario is in when do I actually exit, because I say my measure is segment revenue. And segment revenue I expect to be helped by the acquisition on a permanent basis, then it's difficult to say when do I exit. I may from day one, as soon as it's integrated, not go back to the acquisition because now it's part of the bigger thing. I can't carve it out anyway.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that easy, man? Isn't that when management has done acquisitions, they usually are interested, is it successful or not? And in your example, if they're asking the question to the controller or whoever, saying, okay, is the segment revenue still increasing and relates that to the successfulness of the acquisition, then, okay, you should report that. But in some point in time, management is still asking, okay, what is the revenues of my segments, but don't relate it to the acquisition. And then it should stop. And that is, I think, our... clearly, there is judgment involved, but it is as long as it is a kind of management approach which we propose. Mm-hmm. And management approach would say, okay, is there interest of management in looking about this successfulness of this acquisition? And clearly, if it is integrated, it is what Tim said, there is a point in time, maybe they are still interested in the revenues and the performance of this bigger integration, but is not longer is the acquisition successful, then is the operation successful, is the segment successful, is my ongoing business successful? I think it is a kind of, there is not a clear cut, I think it is judgment involved in this point. At least in my experience, it was in the first years in the acquisition, everybody is okay relating that to the acquisition. After some years, it has gone into the segment or even lower and higher, and then people are not relating the performance of that bigger integration to that acquisition. And there's not a, maybe not a clear cut, but it is a kind of judgment call. That's what I think.
Okay.
Yep. Zhang Wu.
Thank you. That's a very interesting example. Mathematically, maybe sometimes it might not be easy to separate the kind of going concern effect of the combined and also the kind of the synergy effect between these two. Also, but you would like to stop the monitoring the acquired business, also their effects to the combined entity. So sometimes, as you said mathematically, you should have a kind of independent decision. I stopped the monitoring of my acquisitions. I have to go out. But I have been reporting all kind of this performance based on segment reporting. So, but that segment report is going on. So these two scenarios are going there. But as Martin said, theoretically, if you stop monitoring this acquisition, then you should stop and let segment reporting continue. So this is must be a kind of theoretical answer. But in practice, it might not be easy to separate these two. But based on your interesting example, I see some kind of opportunity for preparers to use segment report to replace our disclosure requirement and acquisition, because we are giving some kind of flexibility to you. So if you insist, we are monitoring all acquisitions based on the segment report. So we are going to report the segment report on all acquisitions. So that. Do you think that's a real reaction from preparers when we ask this kind of a specific acquisition disclosures?
I don't know. I think it depends. It depends very much on the company structure.
Yes.
I would be surprised if the company says I'm monitoring the acquisition even on a level higher than operating or more aggregated an operating segment, because then it would need to be an acquisition that maybe benefits numerous different segments that may even be higher. Whether you monitor it on a more granular level than the segment depends very much on what you do with the acquisition. And that's really how independent will it be post-acquisition. Okay. But usually the more synergies you want to have, the less integrated you leave it, because then you cannot get to the synergies.
Okay, next.
Martin. on the screen. On screen.
Who's on? Oh, yeah, Murillo. Murillo and San Yin.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, because I understood that these materials, they are related to the discussion paper that will be published in the near future, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. The slides are a summary of the preliminary views that will be included in the discussion paper and the rationale for those preliminary views. And that discussion paper is expected mid-March.
And what kind of guidance could, if any, should we expect within the discussion paper to help the preparers to identify these measures that could be used to determine whether the acquisition was successful or not when you have business integrated to the business that the company already had? I mean, it's a judgment exercise that will be very complicated to apply. And I'm curious if there is anything that will be within the discussion paper that will help us apply that judgment, or is it something limited to what we have in this presentation here, which is, I mean, it's not much. There isn't much guidance here on what we should do to get there.
Yeah, so there's not additional guidance within the discussion paper. I mean, there's a discussion within the paper about the integration issue and how that might mean, as Christoph explained, actually management may well be monitoring this using some combined information about the combined business because it has been integrated. But there's not any specific guidance within the discussion paper of how companies might go about doing that, and also providing information about how the acquisition is performing, mainly because I guess this is a management approach, and so the basis of the board's decisions and the preliminary view is that the disclosure would be based on how management themselves are monitoring the acquisition and how management themselves know whether an acquisition is underperforming or is outperforming its original expectations. And when asked in analyst presentations how well is that acquisition doing, you know, CEOs and CFOs have an answer, and it's how the basis of that type of basis of that type of answer. And so to the extent that the acquisition is integrated and therefore management are monitoring it on a combined business basis, actually the board is exploring within the discussion paper, well, actually, you know, how do management actually monitor on a combined business basis, but the basis of the proposals are that it's how management actually monitor the acquisitions themselves.
Yeah, Murillo, this is the other way around. It's not that we giving guidance and say, okay, companies we think should be measure their success of acquisition in an integrated basis, maybe on combined revenues or synergies or costs or revenue synergies. That is not. Because if we would have done that, the immediate reaction would be, no, that is not the way we're doing it. And therefore, we decided, okay, the management approach. And if then companies are saying, no, we don't monitor it, also okay. Then you disclose, we don't monitor success of an acquisition, which also tells users something. If you have a big acquisition and management don't think they have to monitor success. Or if you're doing it by synergies, by combined revenues, by whatever. Whatever you have decided, you're monitoring, then you should report that. Yes? Murillo?
The problem is that if management doesn't monitor the acquisition the way it should be, it would be necessary to make the disclosures that are being discussed here. So if there is a overall monitoring of the integrated business and management perceives that the acquisition created a loss or created a huge increase in whatever measure they follow, I don't know if that's enough to comply with the proposals here for disclosure of these measures. And the idea that we should disclose that we are not able to comply with these disclosures is not something that's going to look well. And so there might be there might be some sort of pressure from management so that somehow we would need to adjust to these disclosures instead of essentially use the way management actually monitors their business.
I don't understand that. You?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The proposal or the preliminary view is that if management aren't monitoring it against, I guess, the acquisition targets and against acquisition objectives, but are monitoring, I guess, more generically in the sense of managing the overall business as part of the segment, as part of the business unit that it's integrated in, then the preliminary view is that that companies need to explain that they're not monitoring it in this particular way, and these are the reasons why, we've been told that investors would be interested in that information, and that's why the board has introduced that. But to your point, you were saying, well, as a company, I'm aware that it's contributing revenue or it's contributing a loss or what have you to my combined business. I guess it's that is still how management, I guess, is monitoring that acquisition. There is something there that management is aware of, and is presumably, if they're contributing a loss, then management is reacting to that and deciding, remedial action. And so that would there would still be the information there that potentially a company would be able to disclose, and would investors would find useful.
Maybe it's just worth going back a stage. So the basic idea is that in the year of the acquisition, management would disclose the rationale for the acquisition and the objectives and how they plan to monitor whether the objectives are being achieved. And then in subsequent years, you would disclose those measures that you selected in year one for how you'd measure the progress. Now, obviously, you need to cater for the possibility that you might change what you're monitoring over time because the world changes, and so there'd be a requirement to disclose that if you've changed it. But you don't want people changing it all the time just because they want something better or because it will look better. So there's a sort of balance to be struck there. But that's the basic idea. It's management will be selecting what they think makes sense to them for monitoring the objectives that they've identified, and will then disclose that information.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Ian?
Yeah, I think everyone totally respects that shareholders and investors have a highly legitimate interest in this topic. There's no denying that. And actually, in my experience, they're a lot more streetwise than maybe we give them credit for. I mean, they're very sensitive to the fact that management might be sort of spending large amounts of cash on M&A deals, which could otherwise be going to dividends and so on. So they're very much, I can confirm, we get a lot of questions on this topic, and they do ask about the performance of the business acquired. What they never ask about is goodwill. And so I think, in a way, if we're going to give sort of the users useful information, what they want, I think sort of maybe giving more information on how the acquisition is going is a legitimate line of approach. But then you need to start forgetting about all this stuff with goodwill, because they actually don't use that. It's an onerous process because you have your auditors and regulators crawling all over it. It's highly sensitive. It's always one of these key audit matters. It is judgmental, and it's time-consuming. I wouldn't say it's necessarily expensive, but it takes a lot of time of senior people, senior advisors, all of whom are charging premium rates, to actually get it done. And it is only used by the auditors, academics, the regulators look at it. The analysts don't. We have substantial goodwill impairments, and there's never any questions about it, and there's no impact on the share price. So I think really the goodwill question, where the amortization versus impairment, is actually in no way, from my point of view, a philosophical topic. It's purely a practical topic. The goodwill sitting on the balance sheet really shouldn't be there. And as the guy who's preparing the financial statements, it's like a kind of unexploded bomb that you need to think, OK, what do we do with this? And the advantage of the amortization is it is a way to get it off the balance sheet. I don't think it makes any difference to the users, because they don't look at it anyway. And this is even implicitly recognised in the proposals, because we propose, what we've heard today is we're showing goodwill as a separate line item in the balance sheet, and then we hear here that we're going to have equity excluding goodwill. So it's almost, you know, we all know what's going on here. No one thinks this is a real asset anyway. So from a philosophical point of view, I think if we're going to go down the road of expanding disclosures on the business performance, we need to look at lessening them in terms of the goodwill, in terms of the volume of disclosures, and in terms of that whole process. And this is the advantage of the amortization. It does reduce the impairment process, because you actually, the book value is steadily decreasing, so your impairment risk goes down year by year. It's purely a practical thing. I'm not sure there's any great philosophical change. And maybe one final point on the field work, just a suggestion. You might want to think about going to a smaller number of companies and going into quite some depth, rather than going to a large number of companies and really scratching the surface. Because I think you really need to immerse yourself in this topic. If you just go to a company for 2 or 3 days, you're only going to get a superficial view. And actually, the process here is quite mechanistic. Everyone's doing sort of the same thing. So I'd suggest you really have a focused view, get sort of a small number of companies that are willing to go into quite some depth with you on that. And I think this will then tease out a lot of these issues.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Sandra.
I understand Ian's point of view on amortization, but unless there's compelling evidence to change the accounting for goodwill, I just don't think that a change should be made. And I'm not sure that there has been compelling evidence that the current model is not working and that an alternate model will be a better outcome. And then a second point is on the disclosures. If you look at page 15, it implies that there, synergies are often an important part of the acquisition. I would agree that in many acquisitions that is the case, but then you look at the preliminary view and it says to require. I guess I don't know if require is the correct terminology, but in the event that synergies are an important element, then disclosure of the range, I think, would be a more appropriate way to talk about it. What's currently written would imply that you'd have to come up with something, and I don't think that that's appropriate or useful if management's not going, if it's not part of the strategy of the acquisition to have synergies. You may be doing it just to acquire an asset.
Yeah, I mean the Blim review is it's synergies that are expected by management when they went into the acquisition, so it's only those that they actually genuinely believe are there, as it were. So rather than requiring you to come up with some synergy.
And going back many years ago, I know we had one acquisition where we had identified certain synergies, but if you have a really large acquisition and the business can keep coming up with more and more synergies or expected synergies. So I think encouraging very specific measurement elements would be important because, we had to eventually cut it off because in the end, you might have had all of our outcome be a synergy if you let the business keep going at it. So.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick. And only one comment, because when you said, is there any new evidence that impairment only has not worked? I think some of the board members at least think that, and that is also described then in the DP, because when we had done a post-implementation review, and the outcome was that many people thought, okay, the impairment test is not effective in us. It is a kind of too late and too low impairments. And that is why I think the board and also the staff has worked since some years on to improve the effectiveness test or the effectiveness of this impairment test, which is also described. I think we think is not possible. And then you have to conclude what you think about that. So at least I want to say there is something new. We have new information compared to the situation when the board developed the impairment test. And so there is something has changed. And it's not that we're doing it because we don't have other things to do, because we had done an post-limitation review and they got messages and then we tried to react on that. And
I understand that aspect, but then I look at whether the alternative approach would be a superior or better information, and I don't think arbitrary amortization periods would provide better information.
Yeah. And you are then with the majority of the board's preliminary view. You don't want to change it. Richard.
I do agree that disclosure about the results of acquisitions for the first few years after the acquisition would be very useful. And I like the approach where in the year of the acquisition you identify what your objectives were and then report against those objectives is a good one. Sometimes we all have board presentations where we justify the acquisition. Sometimes when you go in and get your fingers really into it, there's a year later there's a revised version that contains more knowledge and what you actually monitor against is more that one. So that's something to consider. But I think that approach is good. I do agree, I have sympathy for the analysts that say that impairments are too little, too late. I think there's some truth to that, but I don't. We explored other models, and I don't think there are any better models. I do believe that goodwill is a residual, but it can include either unrecognized, intangibles that aren't separately recognized, which would have a definite life if they were separately recognized, or it could be a measure of the ability to generate super profits, which again wouldn't last forever either, so that wouldn't have an indefinite life. So I'm in favor of amortizing goodwill for that reason. I think it better matches what the essence of it is, and it is just a residual, and it will get it off the books eventually. I think the idea of presenting equity less goodwill is really a recognition of that same point. In terms of synergies requiring a disclosure of amount of synergies, I think that would be difficult and of limited use, and it doesn't really recognize that maybe your goodwill is intangibles that aren't separately recognizable, in which case there might not be any synergies. So I don't think that would be particularly useful disclosure of the synergies.
Natalia?
I want to share how this topic is developing with our regulator in banking sector in Russia, because they just reintroduced the amortization of goodwill for 5 years. And I think it's because in capital regulatory area is more important, and goodwill is deducted based on the Basel regulations from the capital. So when you're in a regulatory environment, then we just want financial statements and regulatory requirements in the same field. And also, I would support amortization again and again. I still believe that some intangibles that are not disclosed, and thinking on the term of amortization, if, for example, the purpose of our acquisition was to buy the client base, then it's more related to client relationships, 5 to 7 years. If it's cost, then it might be 3 years, because on 3 years you get all your costs. So it might not be fixed somehow to determine the term of amortization, but I still believe it's more relevant.
Ms. Natalie, Tom?
I wanted to maybe get Richard or some other people who'd talked about the missing intangibles that get sucked into goodwill, and I think Richard used super earnings, but this notion of abnormal earnings, which I think synergies would typically come more from there. And if you read our document or the FASB document or the old basis, they'll sort of talk about goodwill as having synergies, conceptually missing intangibles, and maybe some other. But really the two identifiable are the synergies and the missing intangibles. So with respect to disclosing the synergies, my question is, if there's only the two, is the problem that you really can't sort the synergies from the missing intangibles? Because if that's the sort that seems to me to be critical, I just wanted to get a clarification on what the problem was.
Ian, want to answer?
I can, not necessarily answers, but maybe sort of, I'm not even sure, shedding new light. But I can tell you, the goodwill is residual from the acquisition accounting. So the kind of deals that we do, typically for a small biotech company that really doesn't have much tangible assets, just some intellectual property, you basically end up with intangible assets as your main acquired asset. And the goodwill comes from two main areas. One, when you book the intangible asset, you then have to book deferred tax and the tax amortization benefit, and that's a credit on the balance sheet, and the debit by mathematics ends up in the goodwill. The second point is when we look at acquisitions from a business case, we're using our internal discount rates and our internal rates of returns. So the value that we may assign to the intangible asset will be different from the one that actually ends up on the balance sheet, because when we apply IFRS 3, we have to use a different discount rate. So that mathematically is what drives, they're the two biggest elements that actually contribute to this goodwill number. In addition to that, it's the two items you've said. There can be some synergies there. We really don't know, usually. There's usually some. It's difficult to quantify. And inevitably, there's usually a few early stage research assets that don't meet the recognition criteria, and there's sort of stuff like the assembled workforce. There might be some key scientists that we'd like to get on board with us that also don't meet it. So it's a complete hodgepodge. But I think maybe the mistake people are making, it's maybe our fault, is when we, in existing IFRS 3, we have to explain what goodwill consists of. That's the requirement. And typically, it's very boilerplate if you look what people do, certainly what we do. So people talk about synergies and talk about development of the business. They don't talk about that we paid too much, or they don't talk about that we just wanted to get the deal done. And actually, the reality is the goodwill is a residual from the acquisition accounting, which represents all the factors that I've just explained. And maybe that's our job, the problem, that we haven't been clear enough about that to people previously.
Can I just ask a question about that, Ian? Your discount rate point. Is there some systematic reason why you're implying that the difference between your internal valuation and, I suppose, what you're prepared to pay and the amount you're recognising in the purchase price allocation is to do with a difference in the discount rate? Is there some systematic thing that leads you to one discount rate for one factor and a different one for the other one?
Yeah, if I remember IFRS 3 well, we have to use a market participant rate. Mm-hmm. In Switzerland, we have negative interest rates. And, for example, not in the last years, but a couple of years back, we actually issued corporate debt with a negative bond. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, the discount rate is not really a topic for us in terms of business analytics. We're certainly not in the same areas as sort of the rest of the pharma sector. So it's just a different number, and depending how other people look at it, some people I've seen they have for internal M&A deals they have like a target discount rate that is sort of, I don't know, 5%, 10%, whatever. So what management thinks when they're actually doing the deal is very, what actually ends up in the balance sheet from doing the IFRS 3 calculations, even though they're the same assets, and often they have exactly the same sort of underlying cash flows, but because of the way you use the discount rate and maybe the way you treat sort of working capital and some other stuff, it always spits out a different number. And then again, once you throw in the deferred tax and the TAB, that then flows into the goodwill as well. So I think this is where I think with the field work, if you dig into a few companies in depth, I think you'll start to see these kind of issues with real numbers. And then I think it's maybe not so easy to explain over the phone, but, you know, I think if, you know, you're all smart guys, I think if you saw this for half a day, I think you'd totally get it.
Yes. Building on what he said, it's not just discount rates, it's any of the assumptions in your business combination accounting. So if you're in a commodity-based industry, you're using your internal pricing assumptions on your realization profile. But when you go to your business combination accounting, you have to use third-party sources of pricing that are available. So you could have differences there. So it's all the underlying assumptions that a market participant may use versus internal assumptions.
Christoph?
To echo what Ian said, in the process of making the acquisition, the later accounting for it is completely irrelevant. That comes after the acquisition is done. Then you engage people who do the purchase price allocation. And then you get the accounting side, and those who decided for the acquisition, maybe except for the CFO, mm-hmm. are not overly interested in what comes out. That's why you don't look at something like goodwill. Mm-hmm. You don't think about, oh, how much goodwill does this acquisition generate, and what is this goodwill? And the number of items in which the way you look at it internally and what the IFRS 3 accounting ultimately is, that list of the difference is long. One simple example from our industry, we've got to remeasure contract liabilities, which means that under IFRS we initially generate lower revenues than the company we acquired would have generated. That's something we eliminate completely, even in our non-IFRS measures, because it doesn't make sense, because you see a short drop in revenues, and as soon as the next renewal comes in, revenues go up again. It doesn't make any sense from a management perspective. And that's why the entire proposals look at or appear to assume that companies do acquisition through the eyes of IFRS 3. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not the case. And that's why the question on synergies, and that, by the way, was one of the consensus things in the group, we don't have it. So the principle you laid out a few slides earlier, we don't want you to disclose anything that you don't have anyway. I think the requirement to disclose the synergies in many cases is a violation of that principle, because we don't have it. Yeah, because oftentimes you may do an acquisition in something like, I need synergies to a certain amount to justify the purchase price. Whether my synergies are significantly higher, why would I go into a detailed analysis other than for my own happiness, oh, I made a good price? But that's what you would require. You would require the synergies. And that's why it's not something we have available for acquisitions in many cases.
Liliana.
Thank you. I join Christoph in his analysis. Normally speaking, pricing in our industry, pricing is done applying market multiples. So it has nothing to do with the valorization of fixed asset or the PPA. So after that, we are doing the purchase price allocation, and we try to explain what is not what was not the origin of the acquisition. I completely agree. The second point that I want to raise is market users were concerned about impairment coming too late in the accounting. But I would like to know, or I don't know if you have, the reasons of such impairments. I mean, the reason of the impairments that you saw in the market are relating to new acquisitions or relating to a business that is not going well, and it doesn't matter because the acquisitions that they did or they didn't. The problem is that, according to IFRS, the losing of a bad business is firstly inputted into goodwill. So goodwill is the bad guy always. But maybe it's not the reason for the impairment itself. I would like to know if there is some study relating to that. And thirdly, relating to amortization, I have a schizophrenic analysis, because from the accounting principle standpoint, I would like to see an amortization, because I don't understand why goodwill could be different as a market, as a mark, a trademark, for instance. So trademark could be with indefinite useful life, with infinite useful life. I don't understand the reason behind the no amortization of goodwill. But let me tell you that if there is amortization of goodwill, it's very probable that we will be using MPM in order to communicate to the market, because all our concurrents are not depreciating goodwill. They are under US GAAP, and they are not depreciating goodwill.
Yes. Richard?
I just wanted to emphasize there's always a difference between the DCF that we do as part of the acquisition and then the subsequent IFRS 3. To answer your specific question, it's that we use our own debt equity ratio as opposed to market participant. There's a size, the valuers tend to use the size of the entity you're buying rather than our own size premium. Specific company factor is different. And those all end up in goodwill. All those differences end up in goodwill.
Good. Tim?
I was going to say, should we move on to the second half? Because we've got the...
Yeah, we have only 2 minutes left.
Oh, we've got half an hour.
Maybe you can extend it by...
was it not an hour and a half?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay. I had this old agenda, which it's a session after lunch was only for 1 hour.
Okay. The other topic that we would like to discuss with you today is on the outreach and field work that we plan to do after the discussion paper has been published. We are planning to perform some outreach activities with different stakeholders during the comment period. We are also thinking of performing some field work relating to the disclosure proposals, particularly with preparers. And the purpose of that field work is to really to try to see if the board's preliminary view on the disclosure for subsequent performance could be implemented, how they could be implemented, what the disclosures would look like, what the feasibility as well as usefulness. We plan to have some kickoff meetings with participants to explain these views and then to try to get them to prepare some more disclosures based on prior acquisitions. Then we'll have follow-up meetings with them to discuss and ask questions to better understand the process that is involved in coming up with these more disclosures, as well as the potential issues that actually arise in the preparation of such information. We understand that this fieldwork could involve some information that might be sensitive, so it would be most preferable if the acquisition that is based upon would be something that has already been well known to the market. But if that's not possible, this response will only be shared within the team, and any feedback back to the board will be done on a loading basis. Also, just to reemphasize the focus of this exercise for this field work is to understand how management actually monitor these acquisitions and how these disclosures could look like in practice, rather than the factual accuracy of the information or the numbers that are involved. So with that, we would like to ask if you have any comments to make on this fieldwork plan.
Any comments for the fieldwork? I see the Switzer land flag again, Ian.
I think I made them already. I think what you might find useful is to actually attack it in two parts and first of all look at what the company knows before the deal is finalized in terms of what the M&A team are looking at and what the accounting team are looking at, so you can see that part of it, and then look at the second part, what happened afterwards. And I think then you might get a flavor of the two dynamics that we were talking about earlier. I think if you look at the first part without having looked at the second part, I think it'll maybe sort of put you in the same position that we're in. And that's why, as I said earlier, I think you'd be better advised going to a smaller number of companies and going into some depth. I think you would have to sign some kind of non-disclosure agreement. From our side, I think we'd be happy to host you. I'd need to check that internally. But I think we'd certainly, to make it worth your while, we'd need to show you some pretty confidential stuff. And then we'd need to see how we manage that. But I think this is, I don't know what your timeline for this is, but I would anticipate you may need to make sort of two or three visits to whichever companies you choose, rather than making a small number of single visits.
Okay, thanks for that.
As far as I know, EFRAG is entering into a similar exercise. We've been informally approached by EFRAG whether we'd be willing to provide input. It's always a bit of a shame because to serve different masters is always a difficult piece to achieve. But I'm with Ian. I think you should engage into efforts to better understand not only what companies have, but what do they have at what point in time. Because with all these disclosures, at some point you've got to ask the question, what do I do if I have a measurement period open, if things happen close to period end, so to understand the whole process. I could imagine your life is easier if you tell the companies whatever numbers you provide, falsify them, just give us wrong numbers, because even if acquisitions are some time ago, otherwise you might have an issue with the legal department and stuff. So if you said you're not interested in the actual numbers, then approach the companies and say, we don't even give us the numbers, we don't want them. I think then you got an easier time with non-disclosure and all that. Are you intending to do field work with the user side as well?
Not really so much on the user side. Okay, that's more of a discussion.
Because it would be interesting on the user side to understand the profile of a user who cannot deduct goodwill from equity on their own.
It's called a computer.
That they need it, and they need it prominently on the face of the balance sheet, which is the net of two numbers that both are, in the future, mandatorily disclosed on the balance sheet. I think you will have a hard time convincing us that this is useful information. The prominence piece is something I don't understand, because it's both prominent. If goodwill is there and equity is there, it is prominently enough. I think this is rather something that makes things more confusing if I got different equity numbers on the face of the balance sheet. So that would have been an interesting piece of fieldwork, whether investors who get this make better decisions than investors who have to do this calculation themselves.
We will try to find somebody.
Yeah, we're not necessarily doing fieldwork with them, but we will be doing outreach with them, so, and talking specifically to investors about all the aspects of the preliminary views. So we'll bear that question in mind.
Okay. No further comments? No.
Actually, I have a quick question.
Oh, yeah.
Would you run the whole same exercise actually also for acquisitions where you don't have any goodwill?
Sorry, I didn't catch it.
But then you would run that exercise even for acquisitions that don't generate goodwill.
So the disclosures about subsequent performance?
Yeah.
Yes, because it's a disclosure. Because as Ian sort of pointed out, this is... it's not disclosure about goodwill. It's not information about goodwill. It's information about the performance of an acquisition, and to the extent that that acquisition doesn't have any goodwill, there still must be targets and expectations of management for that acquisition, and so the disclosure requirements about the subsequent performance of the acquisition would be as relevant for an acquisition that has no goodwill as it is for an acquisition that does have goodwill.
And I think one what we learned from the post-implementation review, in the history when we developed the impairment-only approach, or the other boards have developed it, better say, I think it was always a discussion, what is better information, amortization or impairment-only? And it was always people said impairment-only is better information about the success of the acquisition. But for me, the post-implementation review, we learned both have not very high kind of information about the success of an acquisition. And that is, I think, the proposal we now turning it a little bit. We say, okay, maybe goodwill impairment only model is a model, but it is really not the best model for to get investors about information about the success of an acquisition. And therefore, we want to improve that disclosure. I think that is not to link it so much with the goodwill. And therefore, also this question is not about disclosure of goodwill, is about disclosure of the success of the acquisition. If you have goodwill or you don't have goodwill, it doesn't matter in this regard. Ian, yours.
Sorry, a very quick one. Just to clarify, are we talking here about acquisitions or about business combinations? Because since the recent changes to IFRS 3, quite a few of the M&A deals that we do are actually, we're not treating them as business combinations because there's really just one asset that represents sort of 90% of the value. So we don't use IFRS 3, we take asset deals. So when you say investors want to know about acquisitions, are you including,
acquisition
are you
of
talking
business.
Narrowly business combinations defined by IFRS 3, or is it the wider deals?
No, it's IFRS 3 definition.
Yeah, it's business combinations.
Okay. Any further? No? We have a third part, also not. So we think still have 20 minutes.
Should we have a short break?
We can have a short break. We,
but we have a 5-minute comfort break, and then we're coming back at 2:15.